will know that you're coming. So it's free, and you're certainly welcome to attend. So,
I will pass that around.
Our speaker for tonight is Herr Dr. Reverend Mark Bratton.
You always put the ecclesiastical title first.
Oh, okay, sorry, my bad. I don't have enough experience with this. How does that work in England? Because I know in the German system it's like, you know, doctor, professor,
yes,
whatever,
that's right?
Well, professor, doctor, yes. What? Do you just choose one or two? Like, how does that work?
Well, I haven't got two, so it's really an academic question.
Okay. Okay, Mark is an ordained minister in the Church of England, and he works as a parish priest. He also has a doctorate in medical ethics, and teaches medical ethics sessionally at the University of Warwick, and was also practiced as a barrister for a number of years. So his interest is in bringing together a lot of pastoral work and issues with end-of-life care and moral decision-making with sort of the more theoretical side, ethics, law, and this sort of thing. So he will be sharing something with us tonight. I'll hop back up for Q&A, I guess.
Yeah, that'd be
sure.
Great.
Okay, awesome. So,
and I just wanted to say that if you want to ask questions during the presentation, that's absolutely fine with me. But the more we interact during the session, you may want to, because I think I've over-prepared this a little bit. You know, Tom Hulse, I thought I've got to do right by Tom. And I've been thinking quite a lot about it, and you may want to say, listen, you know, that's just too technical, you need to explain that a little more clearly, which I'd be happy to try and do, because this fascinating subject is work in progress, and it's extremely timely. Asking me to come and talk about assisted suicide, given that the committee stage of the Faulkner Bill was discussed just a couple of days ago, in which I've been listening to on YouTube this morning. I used the word advisedly, it's a live issue, it's a hot topic. And I very strong, and the Nicholson case, which was decided in the summer, which is a landmark case as we'll come to see, is an extremely long, complex, but important judgment. And I just thought that I ought to try and unwrap it for you as best I can. But I do so also for another reason. I think that more of us should be reading legal judgments, especially medical legal judgments, firstly, because they're very interesting. And I think most non-lawyers tend to treat the law as if it were an arcane area for anybody, not for anybody but the technicians, and I think that's wrong. The law, particularly these important cases, are matters of public record, and we ought to grapple with them. And secondly, as I will emphasize in relation to the Nicholson case, this landmark judgment, it's what medical lawyers, I think, have quite viscerally called a stigmata case. Just a wonderful expression. The idea being that the case bears beneath the level of the surface dispute the marks of a deeper debate about values. And if that's going on in these areas of extraordinarily important moral and social policy, then you need to know about it. And you especially need to know about it as thoughtful Christians. So that's my little challenge to you all. That's really what I'm trying to convey, albeit imperfectly, this evening. I should have forewarned you, Carl, and got you to roll timpani behind me as I made that point. I have, this is not meant to be death by PowerPoint, but I did think it important in connection with my little challenge to show you as extracts from the judgments to see what they're actually saying in black and white. So that's why there are quite a few PowerPoint slides, but I'm conscious that I don't want to overwhelm you with judicial verbiage. I think it's quite important. So the order of play, if we go on to the, are you doing the, this is just my order of play. I want to consider the context of the assisted suicide debate so that we can put Nicholson in context. There are some important definitional issues to sort out The Faulkner Bill is called the Assisted Dying Bill. Well, what the heck do we mean by assisted dying? You know, it's a rather unhelpful euphemism. Then quite a lot of focus on Nicholson. And then at the end, we'll have time for some theological consideration, but I thought that that might be fruitful to engage in during the Q&A afterwards. And I'll try and launch that with a kind of little theological reflection of my own. What I'm deliberately avoiding is going, well, here's sanctity of life, here's autonomy, here's public policy, here's compassion, you know, these are the arguments for, these are the arguments against. I want to try and subvert that so that it becomes a genuinely convivial interdisciplinary discussion. Okay? There have been shifts in context. And the first shift in context is the judicial context. Nicholson, as I say, is a landmark judgment, but there is a history underlying it stretching back 20 years, which broadly corresponds with the history of medical law itself. These are cases where ethical language is perhaps used, and rarely used explicitly. So one of the earliest, really the first important landmark case in medical law is the case of Tony Bland, who you may remember or may have come across. It was that 17-year-old boy who was crushed at the Hillsborough football disaster in 1989. He lost all higher cortical activity, just a functioning brainstem. 2.5 years, his family consulted with the doctors to have his life-sustaining artificial nutrition and hydration and antibiotic treatment removed, even though he would die inevitably as a result. So this is the first real life and death issue that the courts had to face, and making a number of pretty fine legal distinctions, they decided that it would be lawful in that case to do so. Of course, Tony Bland couldn't make a decision himself, but the court decided that it would be in his best interests to remove what was keeping him alive. So that was really the first one. Another case that I haven't actually put, I should insert there, is the conjoined twins case in 2001. Lengthy judgment, interesting case because judges very rarely, this is the Court of Appeal, repaired to academic literature to help them get a handle on what was legally an unprecedented situation, whether to split one infant twin from the other, even though to immediately kill the weaker twin, another life and death judgment. And then, more relevant to the context of assisted suicide, the cases of Pretty and Purdy, which is the more immediate background to Nicholson, they're attempting to get the judges somehow to get around the blanket ban that the Suicide Act places on assisted suicide. The assisted suicide law is absolutely clear on the face of the statute. You just can't do it. It's a criminal offence with a sentence of imprisonment of up to 40 years. So shifts in judicial context, but there have also been there has been quite a lot of activity in the parliamentary context. The Faulkner Bill, live at the moment, a bill which is explicitly designed to enable competent adults who are terminally ill to be provided at their request with specified assistance to end their own life. So this is a direct attempt by Lord Faulkner to liberalize the law on assisted suicide, but it is not a flash in the pan, because over the last 10 to 15 years, Parliament itself has addressed the question of assisted suicide. Most recently, in the Coroner and Justice Act, where Parliament decided that it would reaffirm the terms of the Suicide Act. You would have thought at one level that would have ended the matter. Parliament has decided, but no, there is still great pressure to get the law changed to make exceptions to it. And further back, Lord Joffe's two private members' bills in the House of Lords, where he himself is attempting to get the law on assisted suicide and voluntary euthanasia changed. And then three House of Lords select committees have addressed the issue. But to date, the law hasn't changed. And it raises the interesting question in the context of Nicholson. Well, come on, guys. I mean, Parliament's made up its mind. Why are we constantly revisiting this issue? That's one way of looking at it. But as we will discover shortly, Nicholson itself may provide a judicial a justification for a way forward. So that's the parliamentary context. Then we have the social context. The social context has been changing. I know that these polls are slightly flaky because the answers you get in them depend on the terms the question is put. But this is an example which is often referred to. A YouGov poll in 2009 claiming that two-thirds of the British population want a change in the law. I've talked about the highly publicised legal cases. Legal cases are important because they often provide focuses for public debate. It's often only when you get a juicy legal case going through the judicial process that the whole country, it seems, certainly the media, comes together to focus for a while on a particular intractable medico-legal dilemma. And there have been an increasing number of those. And then, of course, more broadly, the changing landscape of assisted suicide and voluntary euthanasia abroad. You can take this two ways. You might think that, actually, relatively speaking, there are rather few jurisdictions that have actually liberalized the laws, but a number of them have done so recently, particularly in the United States, with a number of states adopting mainly assisted suicide laws. Oregon is a case in point, but also Vermont and Washington. In northwestern Europe, which is the context most immediate to us, the Netherlands, of course, been operating a policy since the mid-80s, recently put on statutory footing, but the Benelux country, Belgium, has followed suit, so has Luxembourg, and of course we all probably know about Switzerland, where since 1918, assisted suicide has been permissible, provided that assistance is provided without selfish motives. So, shift in the social context as well, and then a change in the historical context. And it strikes me that there are three, what I call, conjunctures, which is a nice little word I've picked up from the historian Ferdinand Braudel, which I think is useful. But there seem to be three conjunctures which is serving to change the moral and the social ecology in this area. Firstly, advances in medical technology. It is trite knowledge now that advances in medical technology now enable the medical profession to keep people alive well beyond the point that life ceases to have meaning for them. 68% of the UK population die in hospital. That rather startled me, although on reflection I shouldn't be surprised. But 68% of the entire population, of 80% of which will have a DNA CPR notice put on their medical notes. A DNA CPR is a do not attempt cardiopulmonary resuscitation.
Are hospitals on in that system?
Say again?
Does that include hospitals with hospitals or outside hospitals? Hospices.
Hospices, I think it includes hospices. Okay, so we're talking about hospitals and hospices. We have the triumph of autonomy. Autonomy is probably the paramount ethical principle in secular bioethics. If you read Eachin Childress's Principles of Biomedical Ethics, it is one of the four, and many think that it's probably the first amongst equals. And the issue, which is at the heart of the drive to liberalize assisted suicide, is that if we have a large degree of discretion to decide decide the way we live our lives, then why should that discretion not extend to the manner and time of our death? And then the third is the rise of human rights, which is at the heart of the legal judgment of Nicholson. This has become the lingua franca of modern bioethics, as we probably all agree. Ethical discourse amongst, in a plural society, tends to be conducted largely in terms of rights. And one of the big challenges we'll see in this case is how we balance these competing rights. Definitional issues. Do please feel free to subvert me if that would help you. I'm just conscious that it is quite a technical area. We often hear about the rhetoric of right to die. We have a right to die. And again, that kind of rhetoric is unhelpful because, of course, the right to die could mean one of five distinct things. Firstly, and I include this for the sake of completeness, the right to refuse burdensome medical treatment. Again, it's trite, you know, trite law and trite professional practice that if you treat a patient, it has to be optimum medical treatment. And if the treatment is futile and burdensome than it's, or more burdensome than beneficial, then you're being professionally irresponsible. And of course, in the Bland case that I talked about, the issue there was withdrawing allegedly futile and burdensome treatment. The argument in that case was that artificial nutrition and hydration wasn't doing him any good. He wasn't going to improve. Let's withdraw. That was hugely contestable, still is, but that's the way it was justified. The right to refuse all medical treatment. All competent adults have an unqualified right to refuse all and any medical treatment, even if it's life-sustaining treatment, even if by refusing it you're doing yourself harm. You have an unqualified right to do so. It was a bit flaky for a while in the 1990s, as far as heavily pregnant women were concerned, but the courts eventually established clearly that even heavy pregnancy wasn't a justification for overriding the right.
And saying that doesn't apply to psychiatric courts?
No, the Mental Health Act offered one exception to the rule, that where you're being treated for a mental disorder and you pose a risk to yourself and to other people, then you can be detained non-consensually to treat that mental disorder and the conditions that are ancillary to it. And actually that's relevant to the right to rational suicide. That, in a sense, that's what I was trying to address there, provided that you're not detained under the provisions of the mental health legislation. You have a rhetorical right to commit suicide. Of course, the courts don't agree that there is a right to commit suicide. You just have a commission. But, and then you have the right to commit, the right to assisted suicide, or the right to be killed by medical means. Now, in this context, what we're principally concerned with are the last two, but it's important to put those two alleged rights in the context of what the right to die might otherwise be. Two important distinctions in this context, if we go to the... go on, Carl.
I was just going to ask, what's the difference between assisted suicide and suicide by medical means? What is the medical means there?
Well, we would be talking about physician-assisted suicide.
Okay, so where the person is a physician as opposed to like a state employee, someone who works in the state in another capacity?
I don't know what kind of agent you have in mind when...
I don't have precisely the information, but isn't it not in Netherlands, but in one of the states that does have legal assisted suicide? They've tried to dodge this sort of problem about suicide in medicine and these two by making it distinct. so that the people who are assisting with suicide are actually not doctors or something like this?
Right.
Does that ring a bell?
I'm sure you're right. I haven't.
Okay, so assisted suicide could just
but
be like,
in principle, yes, I'm
like. Yeah. So assisted suicide could be just like a friend or something.
Well, yes. I mean, assisted suicide, that's an umbrella term
to
include doctors. But I think in this country, when we think of assisted suicide, we're thinking principally of physician assisted suicide.
Okay.
So, yes, that's an important thing to do.
That's just sort of one instantiation of assisted suicide.
Exactly.
I see.
Okay. Exactly. There are two important distinctions which I mention at this point because they are relevant to the Nicholson case. The first is the distinction that was particularly drawn in the Bland case between an act and an omission. Now, this evidently relates to behavior, and it raises up tricky issues of causation. You know, who brings the patient's life to an end? This was particularly relevant in a case that I listed earlier, the case of Ree B, which concerned a 40-year-old woman who suffered a brain hemorrhage and ended up being paraplegic and ventilator dependent. She was perfectly intelligent and competent, and she requested her treating clinicians to turn off the ventilator, which they initially refused to do because they felt that she'd die immediately as a result, and they felt that that attacked the very integrity of their calling as doctors. Anyway, after an 18-month legal battle, the High Court decided that she did have the right because she was competent and she had a right to refuse all and any medical treatment. Ventilation is classified as a form of medical treatment. But the question is, well, the switching off of the ventilator, how do you characterize that? You know, lawyers who want to honor the legal principle classify it as an omission, and you're off the hook. But if we classify it as an act, then it becomes a murderous act, which demonstrates how wafer thin the dividing line is between professionally responsible behavior and murderous behavior. So that's an important distinction. And the other one is probably better known to you, is the distinction between intention and foresight. The doctrine of double effect, or as it's sometimes called, unintended consequences. The idea there being that we are culpable for the outcomes we intend, but not necessarily for those that we foresee. Now, where foresight ends and intention begins, again, is a rather flaky boundary line, but those who are in favor of the distinction will argue that it's perfectly serviceable. Those who are against it will argue that it's a distinction without a difference, and why shouldn't we be as culpable for what we foresee as for the outcomes we intend? So if there are any closet utilitarians amongst you, you should be smiling quietly at yourselves. So let's go on to Nicholson now. As I said before, this is a stigmata case. You really do see beneath the surface dispute the real battles of value which underpin the legal analyses. This is why I think the case is so fascinating, and you ought to do a kind of little ferreting exercise yourselves. If you can stand the fact that it's 366 paragraphs and 132 PDF pages long. Okay, I have suffered for you tonight. I have suffered. And every time I repair back to the legal judgment, I find new complexities. It's an extraordinary case for a number of reasons. There were 9 judges appointed to the panel. That is almost unprecedented. Most highest court judicial panels are made up of 4 or 5 judges, but there was a real recognition that this was a case of monumental public importance and that 9 judges ought to be appointed. And unusually, each judge offers a judgment, a decision, which makes it quite a complex exercise identifying what they have in common and where they differ. It was a widely publicized and harrowing case. It involved 3 appellants. Tony Nicholson, you're probably aware of. He suffered a brain hemorrhage and was eventually Ended up in a condition which was described by the court as being a locked-in syndrome. He was joined in the High Courts by Paul Lamb, who was a man who was immobilized in a car accident and could only and felt that the condition in which he found himself was undignified and painful and unendurable, and also Martin, who had a brainstem stroke and was incommunicado except save for the use of an iBlink computer, which was recently made available to him. And the legal strategy, and this is where it becomes a little more technical. Basically, there were two issues before the court. Is the blanket ban on assisted suicide, Section 2 of the Suicide Act makes it absolutely clear that it is a crime to assist another, to assist the suicide of another. Is that blanket ban incompatible with Article 8 of the European Convention on Human Rights? In other words, is the absolute prohibition incompatible with a human right? Okay? On the face of it, human rights trump statute law, at least at the level of ethics. It's often described as kind of higher law. But the European Convention on Human Rights has been largely incorporated into British law through the Human Rights Act 1988. So these rather widely drawn ethical provisions that you get in the European Convention are actually now the words of statute. And judges are trying to work out how to deal with basically ethics in a way that they haven't had to do at the level of common law and statute. So that was the basic issue, the main issue. There was another issue, which was whether the Director of Public Prosecutions ought to make his prosecution policy a little clearer than he has to date. But that wasn't the main issue. Go to the... This is the assisted suicide law. Remember that I said that it was reaffirmed and redrawn by the Coroner and Justice Act. It's basically the same, just some of the wording has been brought to up to date. Aid, abet, counsel, or procure is rather dated language. So a person is guilty of assisted suicide if he or she does an act capable of encouraging or assisting the suicide or attempted suicide of another person, and the act was intended to encourage or assist suicide. Just a little Radio 2 factoid for you, which you can impress your friends with at dinner parties. Did you know that when the Suicide Act was enacted, it was the only example of a statutory offence where the principal offence was to assist a non-crime? Suicide having been decriminalised by the very same act. So assisting a non-crime was the principal offence. I just thought you'd be interested. Do you know the only other statute which is comparable, where the principal offence consists in assisting a non-crime? Let me tell you, it is the Female Genital Mutilation Act of 2003, I think. So there you are. Anybody a lawyer here? Good. When you have a dinner party with lawyers, you can challenge them. The other important element of this act is Section 4. This is terribly important. It says no proceedings shall be instituted for an offence under this section except by or with the consent of the Director of Public Prosecutions. Now, the important point here is that it is ultimately the responsibility of the Director of Public Prosecutions or one of his delegates to decide whether it is in the public interest to bring prosecution. And this is where a lot of the controversy has lain, because in most of the cases that have crossed the DPP's table, he has decided in the public interest not to draw prosecution. Which means that advocates of assisted suicide have said, hey, look, we've got an assisted suicide law de facto. So why don't we just regularize the de facto position, enshrining it in law? So that is why this is important. Then the European Convention, everyone, Art- Article 8.1, everyone has the right to respect for his private and family life as human correspondence. This is the crucial article because the courts, in a number of cases which have gone before the European Court of Human Rights, have read an autonomy right out of the right to privacy. We have, this is the way I tend to conceptualize, a prima facie right to determine the manner and the time of our deaths. We have a human right to autonomy. And the big question is, does the state have a justification for qualifying that presumptive right under Article 8.2? And you will see that Article 8.2 stipulates that there shall be no interference by a public authority, i.e. the court, with the exercise of this right, except such as in accordance with the law, has to be lawful, and is necessary in a democratic society in the interests, and then there are four exceptions, national security, number one, public safety or the economic well-being of the country, two, for the prevention of disorder or crime, three, fourthly, for the protection of health and morals, four, actually there are five, or two can be conflated, or for the protection, this is the crucial one, for the protection of the rights and the freedoms of others, which in this case refers to the weak and vulnerable citizen who might be subject to coercion of various kinds. So the question is, can the absolute prohibition on assisted suicide be justified under Article 8.2? That is the issue, and it is over that issue that the judges in Nicholson wrestle with each other. And it seems to me that there are basically two fascinating features of this case that we need to think about. Firstly, the ethical complexity of it. As Lord Sumption said at the beginning of his judgment, a significant judgment, he said, we can't avoid morals in this case. In spite of our rhetoric, this is a court of law, we're not arbiters of morals, we cannot escape morality in a case which presents such a pressing issue of moral, social, and public policy. And there are three elements that I want to draw your attention to. Firstly, disagreements over the symbolic significance of the decriminalization of the Suicide Act. Secondly, the discussion about the limits of personal autonomy. And thirdly, the impact that any legal change might have on the vulnerable. And then the other crucial issue is the issue of constitutional legitimacy, another major issue. The question being, no, who's got the legitimacy to decide these issues? Is it the court, unelected judges, or must it be our democratic representatives in parliament? So there's a real issue here about where the judicial function ends and the parliamentary function begins. This matter has been complicated because of the Human Rights Act 1998. So let's go on to suicide and sanctity. This is a fascinating issue. Suicide was decriminalized in 1961. It was no longer a statutory offense. We need to remember that before the Suicide Act was enacted, it was a statutory crime, and before that, it constituted the common law offense of self-murder. And it was a capital offense if you survived a suicide pact, and people were hanged. Yeah, suicide was decriminalized. But what is the significance of this? Now, Lord Sumption argued that the sanctity of life is not compromised by the decriminalization of suicide, because what that represented was not a moral affirmation of the right to commit suicide. It was a humane and pastoral response to people, obviously to survivors, who required not the full force of the law, but pastoral and medical help. However, Lord Neuberger, who delivered the leading judgment, his is the longest judgment, argued that sanctity of life, the principle of sanctity of life, is undermined by the decriminalization of suicide. And if suicide has been decriminalized, then what principled reason is there for not decriminalizing assisted suicide? I was talking to you, Carl, over lunch. You know, this is a good example of where you kind of do a gestalt shift. You look at it in one way, seems perfectly logical. You look at it another way, that also seems perfectly logical, but what to do? Lord Sumption, now this is where we get into the black letter law. This is, I think it's important to read what they actually say. Lord Sumption said, it was that imposing criminal sanctions was inhumane and ineffective. The idea of taking these desperate and unhappy individuals from their hospital beds and punishing them for the attempt was as morally repugnant as the act of suicide itself. It was ineffective because, assuming that they truly intended to die, criminal sanctions were incapable by definition of deterring them. Okay, that's Lord Sumption's approach. Lord Neuberger, in contrast, argued, I find it hard to see how a life can be said to be sacred if it is lawful for the person whose life it is to end it. And he says very interestingly here, I am somewhat skeptical about semaphore, that sign-bearing, justifications for legislative or judicial decisions. That's an important point, because for Lord Sumption, the law has expressive value. It symbolizes the moral norms, such that they be, that lie at the heart of the law. Lord Neuberger is skeptical about the expressive function of the law, and perhaps that's something that we can debate slightly later on. Is there this separation between law and morals, as modern legal philosophy associated with Herbert Hart would have us think, or is the law, as Francis Bennion once put it, the hard edge of ethics. Then, the limits of autonomy. Clearly, an absolute prohibition on assisted suicide is autonomy limiting. However, as I pointed out to you earlier, there are other areas of medical law which appear to be autonomy promoting. And indeed, since the first case of Tony Bland, almost every medical legal case has emphasized the paramount importance of autonomy. And that autonomy is affirmed even in a case like the case of Miss B, who had her request for the discontinuance of a life-sustaining ventilation honored, albeit after a bit of a fight, because the switching off was characterized as an omission. That is autonomy promoting. The judges make this explicit. However, assisted suicide is autonomy limiting. What is the justification for that? Is the limitation of autonomy in the assisted suicide context justifiable? Lord Sumption said yes. He argued that sanctity of life is a fundamental moral and social value, and that the act of suicide is an expression of personal autonomy, where he draws this distinction. The act of suicide is an expression of personal autonomy which the law no longer criminalizes. In contrast, assisted suicide is ethically based on the underlying motivation of compassion rather than an extension of the autonomy of the person wishing to end his life. To go back to the gestalt shift, that's Lord Sumption, but what does Lord Neuberger say? Almost entirely the opposite. To my mind, the difference between administering the fatal drug to a person and setting up a machine so that the person can administer the drug to himself is not merely a legal distinction. Founded as it is on personal autonomy, I consider that the distinction also sounds in morality. What he's saying is, actually, assisted suicide is an expression of personal autonomy to be distinguished from voluntary euthanasia, where you die at the hand of a third party. The person concerned has not been killed by anyone, but has autonomously exercised the right to end his life. Lady Hale, at paragraph 304. Again, I'm sorry to labor it a little bit, but you've actually got to see, read what they're actually saying. Lady Hale, while this distinction may make sense to us, judges and lawyers, this is the distinction between killing and helping die, let him die. It must often make little sense, especially to those who suffer the cruel fate of paralysis, those who can breathe without artificial help, a denied choice, which those who cannot do so may make, should they wish to do so. For some of the people looking after them, it will be a mystery why they must switch off the machine or withdraw artificial nutrition and hydration if this is what the patient wants, but they may not painlessly administer a lethal dose of medication which the patient wants just as much. You know, if, basically she's saying that Miss B was lucky. She couldn't breathe unassisted. If she could, then she wouldn't have been able to bring her life to an end in the manner and time of her choosing. And Lord Kerr, who was very closely associated with Lady Hale, and much of what he said, if I wish to die and am physically unable to bring the medication that will bring my life to my own, that will end my life to my own lips, but have someone who will do that for me, I'm acting just as freely by having them do so as if the hand that bore the draft was my own. So you can see here that some fairly fine legal distinctions are being put into operation, undergirded by significantly different values. Lord Sumption is wanting to maintain the clear, bright line, but three of these judges are wanting to blur it. And this harks back to a point that Lord Mustel made in the Bland case in the House of Lords. He said, the law in this area is intellectually misshapen because I can't understand why it should be lawful to allow a patient to dehydrate and starve for 3 weeks and not administer him a quick lethal injection. Now, the issue about the vulnerable is this. Basically, Lady Hale's approach was in answer to the question about whether Article 8 was incompatible with Section 2 of the Suicide Act. Her point is this. The problem with the Suicide Act is that it admits of no exceptions. She says that to the extent that the current universal prohibition prevents those who would qualify under such a procedure from securing the help they need, I consider that it is a disproportionate interference with their life to choose the manner and the timing of their deaths. It goes much further than is necessary to fulfill the statist aim of protecting the vulnerable. It fails to strike a right balance between the rights of those who have freely chosen to commit suicide but are unable to do so without some assistance and the interests of the community as a whole. So that's right. And she wanted to declare, she did declare the Suicide Act and the European Convention incompatible. This admits of no exceptions at all. The balance has not been properly struck. I'm conscious that it's gone quarter past, but we can weave this into discussion. But I just want to deal with the issue of constitutional legitimacy, because it's really very odd. In order to decide whether the Suicide Act is incompatible with the European Convention, you can only properly take three views. Firstly, it clearly is compatible. Generally speaking, that's one of your options. You can either take that view, it's clearly compatible, or you can say, the statute is clearly compatible with human rights, or you can take what I call the stretched compatibility, which is, although there's a bit of a doubt about whether it is compatible on the face of the statute, by stretching the meaning of the words, which we're entitled to do under the Human Rights Act, we can make it compatible. This is what's called reading up a statute. That's an interpretative device that the Human Rights Act gave to judges. If you can stretch the words to bring them into alignment with human rights, that's fine. Or thirdly, you declare that the statute is incompatible. Now, in this case, only two judges were prepared to do that, Lady Hale and Lord Kerr. They said they're incompatible, doesn't admit of an exception. We don't think that the vulnerable who are capable of committing suicide will be made any more vulnerable by extending the right to an assisted suicide to those who can't commit suicide. Declaration of incompatibility, which means, in practice, the issue is remitted to Parliament. Parliament, you need to decide what you're going to do with this. You need to decide whether you're going to change the law, and if you are going to change the law, then change it informed by our legal analysis. Two other judges said, no, this is a matter for Parliament. This is an issue of fundamental moral and social policy. This is not the remit of the judges. Parliament needs to decide. However, and this is where the real controversy lies, five of the judges took a wait-and-see approach. Okay. Now, strictly speaking, you can't take a wait-and-see approach. You've got to decide, is it compatible or isn't it? They left things hanging in the air, and I just want to end with this. Lord Nor, just next one. Yeah. Because this is where, because basically what this is, it's rather like a tutor of yours giving you an essay and saying, do it again, without giving you any guidance whatsoever about what it is that you need to do in order to satisfy him. This is what I think the Supreme Court has done. Five judges, that's the majority. Parliament has now had the opportunity to address the issue of whether Section 2 should be relaxed or modified, and if so, how? In the knowledge that, if it is not satisfactorily addressed, there is a real prospect that a further and successful application for a declaration of incompatibility may be made. Basically, he's saying, you know, if you don't sort yourselves out, Parliament, another case will come before us, and we may then issue a declaration of incompatibility. Not very helpful, because the Parliament's going to think, but what do we have to do? It would not be appropriate or even possible to identify in advance what amounts to a reasonable time in that this context. Well, that's not very helpful. However, bearing in mind the predicament of the applicants and the attention the matter has been given inside and outside Parliament over the past 12 years, one would expect to see this, the issue, whether there should be any, and if so, what legislation covering those in the situation of the applicants, explicitly debated in the near future, either along with or in addition to the question of whether there should be legislation along the lines of Lord Faulkner's proposals. Nor would it be appropriate to identify in advance what would constitute satisfactory addressing of the issue, well, that's helpful, or what would follow once Parliament had debated the issue. That is something which would have to be judged if and when a further application is made. So that there is no misunderstanding, I should add that it may transpire that even if Parliament did not amend Section 2, there should still be no declaration of incompatibility. That is a matter that can only be decided if and when another application is brought for such a declaration. So basically, I mean...
What's going to change until there's the next...
Well, I mean, it's all up in the air, and, you know, four of the other judges made similar statements. It is, as I say, it's a totally open prospectus. And there seems to be no clarity about where the judicial function ends and where Parliament begins. I mean, judges under the Human Rights Act, as I say, are empowered by Parliament to issue a declaration of incompatibility, to say this statute is incompatible with that particular human right. But it seems that five of the judges have simply not made a decision and have really left things very much up in the air.
Sorry, what did the other four judges say?
Broadly similar things, if I can put it like that, with varying degrees of strength. I think... they also added, I mean, one of the problems in Nicholson case was that in addressing the question about whether the vulnerable would be impacted by a liberalisation of law, unlike the recent Canadian case of Carter in Canada, where primary evidence about the threat that legal change would make to a vulnerable and weak person, there was no evidence presented in this case, and what evidence was presented, no primary evidence, what evidence was presented was secondary and partial. The Faulkner Commission report, for example, whose members didn't agree amongst themselves, and people who were against a liberalisation of law and principle didn't bother to contribute evidence to the commission. So, you know, that's pretty flaky. I'm conscious that I've gone over time, but in terms of theology, I've been thinking around the theme of God's hospitality. What does it mean to be hospitable to each other? I'm speaking obviously in explicitly Christian terms here, but as Christians we affirm a convivial God. At the very heart of our liturgy is a meal. Christianity is intrinsically convivial, it's Eucharistic. And therefore I've been really trying to develop this theme a little further. And I've got a little bit of a case study, which is an update on a thought experiment. I think it's Gilbert Mylander, who's a moral theologian, but I'd just like you to imagine this. Imagine that you have invited friends to dinner. The atmosphere is convivial, the food is great, the wine flows, the conversation bubbles. You are hospitable and courteous to your guests, whatever the shifts in mood. However, there comes a point when the party begins to wind down, a time to acknowledge that the evening is over. At a point not determined by the clock, conversation, or basal metabolism, you do not press your guests to stay but let them go. Indeed, you may have to signal that it's acceptable to leave. The good host will never be sure of her timing and will never kick out her guest. Her jurisdiction is limited to taking care and permitting departure. The good host recognizes boundaries. She knows that it would be inhospitable to throw her guests out into the street before the party is run down. At the same time, she recognizes it would be inappropriate to cajole her guests into staying when it is clear that they need to move on. Between these two extremes, the good host has a degree of discretion to act, which she exercises on the basis of her experience, her judgment, and her skill. I know that thought experiments like that can break down at a number of different points, but I think they're quite helpful for framing discussion. As Christians, you know, how do we bring our sort of theological perceptions and intuitions to bear on issues that have been addressed with precision by moral philosophers and bioethicists? It seems to me, this is one of my worries, that as a Christian community, we tend to run on two circuits. You know, we've got a nice theological community here who will, on the basis of theological principle, draw inferences right down to ground level immediately, sort of ignoring these difficult distinctions that secular bioethicists draw to our attention. And then, on the other side, you know, on the other circuit, you know, and I think this is where most of us lie, you know, most of our medical ethics is taken in through the skin based on what's reported in the media. And my interest is how do we reconcile these two circuits? It seems to me that theology needs to be brought into rigorous conversation with what secular bioethicists are advancing. And really what I want to know is, you know, when we come across a stigmata case like this, are we simply going to dwell in our little silo, pay lip service to it, but operate in a kind of theological bubble? Or can we bring distinctly Christian moral concepts to bear on secular bioethics and on the law. So that's what I want to leave with you. There's a lot of black letter law in there, I'm sorry, but I hope at the very least you now have a feel for the value dividedness of the judges and the subtle interplay between judicial ethics and legal analysis. Okay?
Thank you. Questions?
Tutu recently came out really in reflection on Mandela's passing, and basically my understanding from reading one newspaper article was that he was basically saying he is for assisted suicide.
And like Lord Carey as well.
Dying.
Yeah.
And so I'm you know, this is a debate that's not at the cusp of the public debate in a South African context. Although it had particular relevance to the kind of saga around Mandela's death. But I'm just wondering what other figures within British society that come from Christianity more broadly have come out publicly. What does the debate look like amongst public Christians?
Well, I mean, this is fascinating to talk about the pews. I think that the official position of the Church of England is fairly conservative. They think that assisted suicide is wrong in principle, and even if not wrong in principle, bad in practice, imprudent. But people in the pews are much more divided. You know, public opinion in the pews does not reflect the official, although I don't know, I mean, that's anecdotal. I don't know what empirical analysis has been carried out, and it would be very interesting. I think Linda Woodhead from Manchester University has done some work on this. But more publicly, Lord Carey, former Archbishop of Canterbury, until very recently, who had been adamantly opposed, has now come out in favour. And I want to express this in a proper way. I mean, he believes that there is an argument, there is a case for physical assisted suicide, which you can hold to with theological integrity. And it would run along the lines. And Paul Badham, who's a professor of religion, has written a book making the case, the religious case for assisted suicide. But the argument would go, listen, you know, we have God-given autonomy. Part of what human dignity consists in is being able to make decisions relating to the way we live our life. You know, that is proper autonomy. We do have God-given self-determination. If we have discretion to make lives which affect the living of them, then why can't we extend that discretion to encapsulate the end of them? You know, why draw the boundary line there? What's so special about death if you regard death as part of life? This was an argument that Hans Kuhn, the German theologian, the Swiss theologian, made some time earlier. He likened human life to a novel, and should we not want to tie up the loose ends of the themes of our life in a way that we think will bring it to an integrated conclusion? So I think those are the sort of arguments, in addition to arguments which their non-religious co-belligerents will share, that actually, if you can't control the pain, then it may be right to kill the patient or to allow him to bring his own life to an end. That's broadly speaking the way that they would put the argument. And again, sorry to keep pointing out Carl because of our very brief discussion, but again, it's gestalt, isn't it? I mean, it's, you know, you look at it one way, it seems to make a lot of sense. You look at it another way, it seems to make a lot of sense. Is there any kind of transcendent yardstick for distinguishing between the rightness and the wrongness of either position? I'll have to leave it to the transcendentalists amongst us. But,
Raj, I mean, I think this would be a very good case study. I mean, you know, if we're exploring that kind of tension. You know.
I was just trying to reconsider that the one of these kind of gestalt issues you have mentioned to do with the two views of autonomy, I think, from Neuberger and...
Assumption.
Yeah. Would it be possible for you to restate that? I've just lost the... I can't remember exactly what the... both saw an opposing decision respecting autonomy.
Sumption was drawing a distinction between suicide and assisted suicide, and arguing that committing suicide was an expression of personal autonomy. Assisted suicide was not, in the same way. What motivates the assister, is the underlying motivation of compassion. So he seems to disaggregate the suicidee, the assisted suicidee, from the assister. So there isn't a symmetry for Sumption, and that's the way I read him. Whereas for Neuberger, he says, listen, I think what he's saying, if suicide is no longer a criminal offence, then what principle justification is there for not allowing a person who wants to commit suicide and would otherwise do it, were he capable, from having that assistance? You're simply providing him with a kind of prosthetic. Now, that, I think that's really where the difference is. I think that Assumption would want to say, actually, the assistant's not just a prosthetic. He's a human being, you know, with feelings and beliefs, who may well, I mean, although I don't think he uses the sanction, may be well corrupted by behaving in that way at some level. I mean, he doesn't use that language, or certainly not language that strongly. And again, I'm sort of reading into what he might be thinking. He would say that the moment, although there may be a kind of certain superficial tidiness for thinking in the Neuberger way, actually, the moment that you get a third party involved, it immediately becomes a matter of public policy on which society should collectively take a decision. I mean, so I'll come over here and... Again, my challenge was, you know, to take the law seriously. These judges are making decisions of great moment. Do you have any feelings about that? Do you have any feelings about where judicial authority should end and where parliamentary authority should begin, I guess? This problem has been complicated by the Human Rights Act, because what the Human Rights Act did was to empower judges to make a decision about whether this statute and that human right is compatible. So it never is, and Lady Hale made this argument very clearly. We're not arrogating to ourselves a responsibility that is Parliament's. You yourselves, Parliament, have given us this authority, and we're judicially bound to use it. Before the Human Rights Act, there wasn't that problem, because the law developed on a case-by-case basis, common law principles, and judges, and the Bland case is a very good case in point, made it very clear that the Bland case was not a case of voluntary euthanasia, although some commentators argued that it was passive euthanasia, but perfectly responsible medical conduct. And that any policy decision made in this area would need to be a matter for Parliament. But the Human Rights Act has given judges in these conflict cases the authority to remit matters to Parliament for decision.
What happened in the cases where the decision was made?
Sorry, say again?
Okay.
in coma.
And the patients are in coma for many, many years.
Yes, PVS, like
yeah,
Lam,
and they
yes.
can't, you know,
no.
They can't say anything about the family have to.
Yes. That's right. And in the Bland case, I mean, the reason that was justified, I mean, really, that was at the family's instigation. Doctors agreed with them, but the doctor said, actually, we don't know what the legal status of this act will be, this medical conduct will be, unless we get the court to make a legal declaration. So that's what happened. They said, listen, we don't know what the legal position is. We need an authoritative ruling. So they went to the family division of the High Court, and then it was appealed to the Court of Appeal, and then eventually the House of Lords. And the House of Lords decided that artificial nutrition and hydration was not basic care, which doctors are under an obligation to give, but medical treatment, which can be withdrawn if it's futile or burdensome. That was the legal logic. Now, the reason why that decision was criticized by many legal commentators, also it was also supported by many, was, wait a minute, okay, we may not be able to improve his condition, but actually, you know, this treatment won't improve his condition, but it is keeping him alive. But the court didn't look at it at that level. It said, it simply addressed the question, is it going to make himself better? No, it isn't. Is it achieving anything for him beyond keeping him alive? No, therefore it's futile. And therefore there's no legal obligation to continue it. The question that they left open was whether there was a legal obligation to withdraw it, but that's another matter. Very good example of the way judges, and this is not meant to sound cynical, but judges will make a decision about what the right outcome should be and then try and find legal justification for it. I think that they all agreed with the family and the medical profession that Tony Bland's life needed to be brought to an end. But if they classified ANH as basic nursing care, they'd have to continue providing it. Nothing could be done. So they classified it as medical treatment. If they classified the withdrawal as an act rather than an omission, they'd be open to a charge of murder. But they classified it as an omission, which, if it's an omission in line with professional duty, is perfectly lawful, indeed professionally responsible. So you can see the way in which these legal concepts are terms of art, which can be manipulated, if I can put it like that, I don't mean that cynically, by judges to achieve a certain outcome.
Would it not just be better then to leave all these kind of cases to judges? Like, basically, I'd almost agree with the five who said nothing.
That is a very good comment, because that is precisely what they're considering.
Yeah.
Lady Hale said, actually, worries about the impact of this liberalisation of law on vulnerable can be addressed. We will have a similar system of judicial scrutiny. So these cases will be, each case will be sent up to the family division of the High Court, and a judge will decide whether the person in question has a voluntary, settled, informed, and voluntary, settled, informed, capable decision where they satisfy those criteria. And in the committee stage, I was listening to this morning, this is precisely the kind of amendment that they want to make to the Falconer Bill. You know, directly led, Lord Panic said, I want to amend the Falconer Bill to include this requirement, a system of rigorous judicial scrutiny.
But won't that, I mean, every time they make a judgment, they'll again be kind of defining what they mean by competent and all those words, those
yes.
five terms. Won't that eventually just, after hundreds of cases, just kind of expand out and eventually assisted suicide will
will be a lot easier because there'll be 100 cases beforehand which they can point to and say, oh, we're just like this case.
Well,
it's slight difference. That's a great comment.
Yes, I mean, I think that you will develop standards as the case law builds up, which is why Lord Carlisle wanted to table his own amendment, did table his own amendment, to make the standard much higher. He wanted to apply a criminal standard of proof to say that unless we are satisfied beyond reasonable doubt that these criteria of voluntariness, etc., are satisfied, we will not sanction it. More than that, the patient will need to be the patient's view of his own suffering will have to be tantamount to inhuman and degrading treatment. That was the other criteria he offered. So again, setting the bar really high, and a lot of the debate in the committee stage was about that, how high the bar should be set. And of course, the opponents of the bill wanted to be set incredibly high, and the proponents, of course, want to get over the vulnerability hurdle. So two great questions. I mean, that's precisely what's being addressed at the moment.
When we talk about suffering, what kind of objective, I mean, I guess it's hard because it's not legal here, but usually when you have to sort of meet a threshold of intolerable suffering or something like this, what kind of objective criteria or medical criteria are in place to define that? Because the problem there, I think, is the subjectivity, or it is kind of a personal value judgment. You can't, it's even a problem in philosophy of mind, right? Like how do you account for pain, this qualia, right? I mean, you can't really reduce it because you can't get inside someone's head and sort of look at, what's, questions about cognitive science and inter-theoretic production side, so what kind of objective criteria have to be in place, or medical criteria, in countries or states where it is legal, in order to sort of then say, hey, okay, now you can decide whether or not it's intolerable suffering or not? Or can it be kind of anything?
Really what I want to do is to do a kind of synoptic study of all the criteria that are in fact applied in these different jurisdictions. I mean, with the Faulkner Bill, it's easy because it's not unbearable suffering, it's terminal illness.
Okay.
So, and I ought to point out, highlight the fact, as many others have, that Nicholson, Paul and Martin, Paul M and Martin would not be helped by a Faulkner Bill. But we know that in the Netherlands, unbearable suffering is an extremely elastic concept, as you probably know, in that it is metastasized from an idea of physical suffering to embrace psychological and emotional suffering, and is now even beginning to encompass the idea of existential suffering, tiredness of life. And the argument of somebody who is probably well known to you, like Nigel Bigger, who I'm sure has probably given a talk here before, he puts this very clearly and powerfully, that if the driving impulse is the principle of autonomy, that we have an unqualified right to determine the manner and time of our death, there's no reason in principle why we should not decide to die for any reason whatsoever. And just to draw a kind of case comparison analogy, we have no trouble, we're not getting hot under the collar here about treatment refusal, but at the very heart of the Mental Capacity Act, which enshrines the common law position, you can make a life threatening treatment refusal for any reason whatsoever. The law makes that explicit. You do not have to make wise decisions. There is a certain logic to the autonomistic impulse that if that is what is driving legal change, then there's no end in it. And Nigel himself draws attention to that very interesting German case of consensual cannabis. Do you know about him? Armin Mewes. He sent out an internet ad, somebody who would be willing to be consensually cannibalized you know, for a return, which obviously he wouldn't be able to enjoy, but his next of kin would. And the German, one of the higher German courts, decided that this was not consonant with public policy. Now, you know, on an autonomistic basis, there's no principled justification for denying what happens between consenting adults. But, you know, all of us would be rather horrified if we allowed that kind of behaviour in our own jurisdiction. So, in terms of the yardstick, it will depend on the jurisdiction, but...
Is it just our sense of horror or kind of repugnance that then holds us back from this?
Well, it could... I'll come on to you in a second. It could be, but then again, you know, what do we make of our moral intuitions? Is it, as Leon Cass once said, the wisdom of repugnance? Or is it, as John Harris has dismissed it, olfactory philosophy? You know, I'm becoming very interested in moral intuition. I think that you know, our intuitions make rationality possible. You know, I don't disaggregate intuition from our rationality, but we do need moral intuition in order to get rationality going. But you've got different points of view on it.
On that point, we mentioned the term dignity a number of times, and with autonomy doing a lot of the work in much of this, in the human rights talk, I think there's an interesting, as far as I understand it, in the interpretation of Kant on autonomy, which a lot of us would go back to in some respect, there's a dispute as to whether dignity is a derivative of autonomy or not. And it seems to me that talking about the nature of dignity and the way in which we construct a kind of meaningful world in which dignity features as a concept must have to do with this kind of stuff to do with moral repugnance and so on. And it might be that there's fruitful discussion to be had by looking at the difference between these two ways of viewing the relationship of dignity to autonomy.
Well, yes, and I think this is an area of very interesting work. I mean, one of your Oxford colleagues here, Charles Foster, who's a fellow of Templeton, Green College, I think, was it called Green Templeton? Is it? Who's also a practicing barrister, has written a book on dignity, and which he thinks is absolutely fundamental. It's fundamental to the convention, it's actually fundamental to Article 8, and indeed in a lot of the jurisprudence these terms are used interchangeably: autonomy, dignity, privacy. Charles would like to see dignity regarded as fundamental, around which all these other concepts constellate. However, that's a fairly rare view, because most of the discourse in this area tends to assimilate dignity to autonomy. Two lawyers, Brownsword and Bailevelde, distinguished two kinds of dignity: the dignity of empowerment, which is basically autonomy, and the dignity of constraint, which is, I think, a more Kantian notion, actually, the idea that there are certain things that you shouldn't allow to be done to yourself. It's a very interesting case, a very interesting French case about two dwarves that used to throw each other on certain, you may remember it.
Well, the case of a free and happy slave.
Yeah, that's right, yes. That's right, you know, this is a contractual relationship. Mm. Why shouldn't we do with our bodies as we wish?
Mm.
And I think that French highest court took the view that the dignity of constraint trumped the other form of dignity. You're right. I think that dignity has a lot of staying power, I think, medico-ethically speaking. But I think that a lot of influential bioethics have been pretty dismissive of it, because they regard it as a rather fluffy concept.
It could be as fluffy as autonomy appears to be if you can make it could turn out that Neuberger and Assumption could actually make a case using the concept of dignity either way, and you get the same gestalt problem, and you don't actually resolve
anything.
So it'd be interesting to hear what has substantively been done on dignity in this particular area.
Well, obviously judges, this is the thing about judicial opinions, they don't write philosophical treatises, they're practical men and women, albeit very highly intelligent. And then it's up to us on reflection to see whether their approaches fit within any particular paradigm. Lord Justice Mumby, a Court of Appeal judge who's also been involved in a number of important medical legal cases, uses the language of dignity much more self-consciously than any of his judicial colleagues. And Charles has made quite a lot of what he said. But yeah, it'll be... Sorry, you had your hand up for a long time. And
it's often said hard cases make bad book. And it seems to me that this is a situation where that's inevitably going to be the case.
Yeah.
I'm thinking about two examples from my personal knowledge. I have a friend who in the Netherlands had no family and had terminal cancer, and who was afraid to go into a normal hospital because she was afraid that the medical practitioners would look at her with no one else who was dependent on her, who was family at all, and simply end her life. In the end, she went into a Christian hospice,
mm-hmm.
where she received wonderful care.
Yeah.
But I became aware that this was an unintended consequence of the Dutch law,
yeah.
to create fear in some people's minds.
Yes. Yes.
Now, the opposite example,
mm-hmm.
is from before that, back in the 80s, in a completely different place, where I knew a GP, and among his patients were two elderly sisters. And at a certain point, one of the sisters died, and he became aware that it was pretty clear to him that the one sister had help the other sister to die.
Yeah.
And he was presented with a choice then to report her to the law, for the law to punish her, or not to report her, at the risk that if it ever came out that he had known about it,
yes.
and not reported it, he would lose his license to practice medicine.
Yes.
And in the end, he chose to endanger his license to practice medicine because he saw no point in having the surviving sister be subjected to the law when she had acted out of love.
And in this jurisdiction, one of the reasons why many people think that untidy though it may be, we've probably got the balance right now in this country, is that the Director of Public Prosecutions makes a decision on public interest grounds whether a person should be prosecuted for assisting suicide, and has set out the factors that will weigh in favour of prosecution and the factors that will weigh against. And one of the factors now, this has been recently clarified by the current Director of Public Prosecutions, that if you are a doctor or a carer who has assisted a suicide out of compassion, that will weigh against the prosecution now. It's not a... Obviously, in the Netherlands, they have different reporting structures. But I guess that in a situation like that, when you're dealing with a caring sister, that would probably be a factor. There would probably be a number of elements that would weigh against the prosecution, although obviously there is always the possibility. Never completes it. But yes, I can appreciate the dilemma that he found himself in. I was slightly disturbed to hear in Oregon, one of the issues that people are particularly startled by is that, I mean, in Oregon, people are becoming increasingly concerned that doctors are initiating conversations about assisted suicide rather than responding to them. And along with that, many insurance companies are not prepared to provide resources for palliative care. So it's kind of, we're prepared to fund your assisted suicide, but we're not prepared to fund an extended treatment of a palliative nature. And this is why it's important to recognize that underneath, of course, each slab of black letter law has a context. There is a moral ecology within which it operates. There is a social context within which it operates. And often it's those subtleties that we learn about only anecdotally. And I think it's this dimension of the assisted suicide debate that I myself find myself out of sync with. Because I'm constantly you listen to advocates of the system, who praise its merits, and then suddenly you'll find a whole load of factors which seem to weigh against its robustness.
Just a comment. It strikes me as difficult to, I guess, measure or somehow record in these cases where people do feel kind of coerced into suicide. It just seems really difficult to be able to get them to report that or to somehow measure that, right? I think that's one of the dangers, I think, in the legalization of assisted suicide, is that all these pressures, you're burdening your family, you can't afford it.
A lot of people just don't want the option there. They feel burdened by the fact that they even have to consider it. And that cuts across the argument often made that, listen, you may be religiously motivated, you may have other motivations for not wanting to change in the world, but that's fine. You don't have to have an assisted suicide, but other people do. Very much a kind of transactional philosophy. It doesn't appreciate that, for want of a better word, the ecological dimensions of medical decision making, that our perceptions of our own condition is very much shaped by the public perception of it. I find that a major difference between the two constituencies.
And just the practical question, or idea that I mean, these things can really sort of fly under the radar, right?
Yeah.
I mean, you can say, we're putting a framework in place that's going to prevent the kind of slide on the slippery slope, but you can't even sort of measure that slide, in this one respect.
Yes, well, the advocates will say, if we have a system of judicial scrutiny, that's not going to be a problem. So,
yeah.
Because we will need to be satisfied.
There's like a very sort of interpersonal kind of dimension to this that's very kind of private and personal, inaccessible to these kinds of...
Which would be my argument against a system even of judicial scrutiny, because I think even those can pass under the radar scanner. I'm happy to answer any more questions, but if you... not that I'm the good host or anything, but in keeping with the philosophy of the host, I don't want you to stay here beyond what would be appropriate. And I haven't kicked you out in advance, so...
we won't kick you out.
No, that's true. It's
Any final questions?
Yeah,
thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you.